The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We take you now to a fantasy land called Milwaukee. The sitcom city on the lake north of Chicago, where the nice white girls Laverne and Shirley work at the brewery, and the town's best-known industry is an old song lyric.
What's made Milwaukee famous and made a loser out of me?
The Democratic Party has failed and betrayed the African-American community. Democratic crime policies, education policies, and economic policies have produced only more crime, more broken homes, and more poverty.
That's Republican nominee Donald Trump arguing yesterday that traditional Milwaukee politics has made the urban center of this city a loser in terms of resources, crime, and economic justice. Is that an argument to vote for Donald Trump, who wasn't speaking anywhere near the inner city of Milwaukee? He spoke to a reportedly all-white audience in West Bend.
No community in this country has been hurt worse by Hillary Clinton's immigration and all of her policies than the African-American community, and she considers them a guaranteed vote.
The tensions in this city from the shooting death of 23-year-old Seville Smith, a black man whose death by a police officer led to riots in the Sherman Park neighborhood of Milwaukee. The tension is still visible. Activists in Wisconsin have noted that the state has the largest achievement gap among black and white students in the United States. 4 out of 5 black children in Wisconsin live in poverty. Milwaukee itself has the distinction of being the most segregated city in America. To talk about all this, we have Mark Levine, the director of the Center for Economic Development at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and Venus Williams, the director of the urban farm Alice's Garden and a community center known as the Body and Soul Healing Arts Center in Milwaukee. Both were quite anxious to dispel pop culture myths about their city.
The frustration that has built up in this community has been building up for decades. And so what people don't understand is when you feel hopeless, when you feel as though your voice does not matter, you find other ways to express yourself and to get the attention of those who you feel can make decisions or who have been making decisions on your behalf.
How would you rate the sort of pop cultural mythology of Milwaukee, the land of Laverne and Shirley and the Bridesmaids movie? Mark Levine, it depicts Milwaukee as this seemingly white, city by the lake that's not Chicago.
There's a reason that Laverne and Shirley was obviously set in the 50s or 60s. Bridesmaids, I can't speak to that, but that has nothing to do with the reality, certainly, of contemporary Milwaukee. Contemporary Milwaukee, the city itself, is a highly diverse city. The migration of African Americans to Milwaukee, which accelerated in the 1960s and 70s, has made the city about 40% black, but the key defining characteristic here is the intense level of segregation, so that 90% of the African Americans in metropolitan Milwaukee live in the central city. Put another way, only about 10% live in the suburbs. That's the lowest rate of black suburbanization in the country. By contrast, as that black migration occurred in the 60s and 70s, you had a rather substantial white flight, such that today in Milwaukee, and this is the sort of the opposite of the Laverne and Shirley notion, you've got about 80% of the region's white population that lives in suburbia, 90% of the region's black population that lives in the city. And so you've got two very different kinds of racial and cultural environments. And the other part of the Laverne and Shirley bit that I think we probably ought to mention is that Laverne and Shirley are obviously working in breweries, and Milwaukee was a highly manufacturing-oriented city in the 60s that provided good, solid, family-supporting manufacturing jobs. Well, Milwaukee's lost 80% of those manufacturing jobs since the late 1960s, and that's had a monumentally negative effect, particularly in the African-American community, where lots of African-American males had gotten those family-supporting jobs in the 60s and 70s and now no longer have them.
Right. Even as a person growing up in Pittsburgh and watching this portrayal of Milwaukee with Laverne and Shirley in Happy Days, when I chose to move here in 1988, my entire family said, there are black people in Milwaukee.
What has that meant culturally to the African-American community, having that level of segregation, the fact that the manufacturing jobs have gone? And, you know, a lot of people don't really know that, you know, big companies like Johnson Wax are in Milwaukee, and one of the biggest financial institutions in the country, Northwestern Mutual Life, is in Milwaukee. And I don't necessarily see them locating their offices in downtown Milwaukee.
Our situation here in Milwaukee in the African-American community is one that has been defined from the very beginning by redlining and where we can and cannot go, where we are and are not welcome. That has, since the jobs have gone away, and since a lot of the population, especially our African-American male population, has vanished from the city of Milwaukee, the feeling of this is not our city, even though we comprise the majority of this inner city, is just a feeling of being invisible.
Venus is exactly right. The disparities between whites and blacks in Milwaukee are incredibly stark. They're among the widest disparities on a whole host of indicators in the entire country. I mean, you know, the typical black household earns about half what the typical white household does in Milwaukee. Those white suburbs that I mentioned earlier are among the most prosperous in the country. And so, you know, Venus is right in talking about Milwaukee being a pretty good place generally for the white community, but on a whole host of indicators, the black community here is suffering mightily.
Venus, what's the message of Donald Trump speaking in West Bend and not right downtown?
I think that it's easy to distance yourself, whether it is physically or emotionally or spiritually, about the reality of this nation, and Milwaukee reflects that. And so for that person to not come to Milwaukee, especially during this week, and address all that has been going on, just quite frankly shows that I'm trying to be polite, so let's not be polite, that his ignorance and platform of hatred and denial is just something that he can continue to get away with by not facing reality.
But let's look at what he did say. And from the standpoint of what you both said about the persistent segregation and lack of economic resources and dignity in Milwaukee, Trump's argument, even though he has no support in the African-American community numerically, is that what has voting Democratic got you there in Milwaukee, over the last several decades? Certainly hasn't gotten you much.
There's always the assumption that because African-Americans have predominantly voted Democratic, that those Democratic laws have been what have prevailed in this state. And that simply is not true. We have been voting, most of us, Democratic, but we have a Republican governor that has taken us back to a different century. And so to think that it's no different than Obama being in office as a Democratic president, but the gridlock and the power that sits within the Republican Party has really been what has determined a lot of the policies and impacts of our state, beginning with Tommy Thompson and welfare reform that didn't reform anything for the African-American community, but simply made life harder.
I think there's blame to go around across the board.
Indeed.
I mean, I certainly don't think that local policy, for example, in Milwaukee has been terribly responsive to the plight of the African-American community. I don't think local policy has been particularly targeted or focused on anti-poverty programs. The big money and the big initiatives are basically on downtown-oriented projects in the community. There's obviously stuff going on in the neighborhoods, but if you look at the disparity in the expenditures on projects, it's extraordinary. And so, you know, you're spending billions of dollars in Milwaukee on subsidies for developers, on subsidies for sports team owners to build, stadiums and arenas. And meanwhile, you've got half of the city's African-American male working age population that today is not working.
Wow. Venus, let me ask you two questions. One, as an activist and as a community organizer yourself, what is it you would like to be able to do right now and can't? And is there any place, any institution, a Brewers game, churches? And I know the answer to that is no. where whites and blacks mix in Milwaukee, any place?
If you were at our farm last night, you would have seen the Rainbow Coalition of the City of Milwaukee. There are spaces and places such as Alice's Garden where the community comes together on almost a daily basis and mixes and represents what you do not see. We always say if the outside of the fence of Alice's Garden could look and feel and have the spirit of the inside of this fence, then the city would be a much better space. What I would like to be able to do when I walk out of this studio today is to have gainful, meaningful, life-supporting employment for every single human being I see. And that's across any color line.
Mark Levine, there is a tradition of economic development targeted at the inner city in the Midwest. I'm wondering what Milwaukee's experience is of that. We've talked about the erosion and diminishment of those services, but the long history of manufacturing and economic development in Milwaukee would suggest that there is a way to bubble this up from the neighborhood organizations that Venus represents.
There's a pretty vibrant grassroots community-based organization sector in Milwaukee. Venus is maybe one of the greatest examples of that, that are doing creative things with urban gardening, urban agriculture. The big dollars, the big resources aren't available in the community for those initiatives. The vast majority of economic development dollars in this community, you know, are spent on these big ticket subsidies for developers or for sports arenas and the like. And so that hard work of rebuilding the base of communities is simply not being supported sufficiently by resources, you know, billions of dollars of resources to turn Central City neighborhoods around. I mean, I'm thinking in terms, quite frankly, of, you know, New Deal kinds of policies, of major public works projects, infrastructure expenditures that will put people to work.
Mark Levine, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Venus Williams, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us about your community and about the initiatives that are actually part of a story we never hear about in Milwaukee.
You are welcome.
Venus Williams is director of Alice's Garden in Milwaukee, and Mark Levine is director of the Center for Economic Development at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. A man in Texas is set to be executed next Wednesday as punishment for the death of a man he did not kill, even though the real killer for that crime was executed in 2002. So why is this man facing the death penalty? Jeffrey Lee Wood was the killer's getaway car driver, and he was found guilty of capital murder under Texas's application of the so-called Law of Parties. Texas has executed 537 people since 1976. Five have been executed under this law. Here to discuss this case and the doctrine of the law of parties is Jordan Steiker, professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law and the director of the Capital Punishment Center. Welcome to The Takeaway, Professor.
Good to be with you.
It's my understanding that in the fact-finding of this case, Jeffrey Lee Wood is the getaway car driver, not the actual killer. And it's my understanding that the Supreme Court has already said that if you drive a getaway car, you're not liable for capital murder in the same way as, you know, if you commit a act of armed robbery or something and someone dies in the course of the commission of that crime.
I think that's right. I think a fair reading of the Supreme Court precedents would suggest that Wood should be ineligible for the death penalty based on his minimal participation in the offense. But, you know, the Texas courts have ruled otherwise and are moving forward with the execution.
What would it take for the federal government or the federal court system, the Supreme Court, such as it is, with only eight justices, to get involved in something like this?
Well, it's very rare for the Supreme Court to get involved in capital cases. I think at this point there is pending litigation in the state courts, but probably the best hope for relief for Mr. Wood would be through the clemency process. Historically, clemency was widely available in cases where the death penalty was being disproportionately applied. In recent years, though, and especially in Texas, clemency has withered considerably.
And that means that the consideration of this law of parties may not even come up in an appeal, that petitions to stop this execution may never actually deal with what we're talking about here?
I think the issue continues to be litigated that Wood is not among the worst of the worst offenders, which is what modern American death penalty law aspires to focus on. And I think he will continue to argue that the execution is disproportionate based on the fact that he was not present and did not intend for the murder to occur. But the appeals in these kinds of cases, when they occur so many years after the conviction, are compromised by many procedural obstacles.
For instance, exculpatory evidence, you know, 90 days after the conviction or something like that, a rule in Texas, makes it really, really hard to bring up any additional facts. It is the case that five other people have been executed under this law. How is Wood's case different than those five people who are already executed?
This is a different kind of case. This is a case where the offender was not present, did not have a weapon, did not intend for anyone to be harmed. So being convicted under the law of parties in these circumstances, I think, is much worse than other imagined and real cases in which the non-triggerman has much greater culpability.
Does this case stand to attract death penalty advocates to insist upon this execution being carried out on time?
It's sort of a strange dynamic in Texas. The death penalty in Texas is withering. There are many, many fewer death sentences in Texas, especially compared to the mid-1990s when this conviction was secured. There are really very few people who are adamantly supportive of the death penalty in Texas. If the death penalty occurs, it's not going to be because of a swelling of support for the execution, but sort of the benign neglect of the system to be able to correct a manifest error.
What is the mental health state of the defendant at this point, or the death row inmate at this point? And is that in any way an issue in this case?
Well, it has been an issue in the case from the beginning. Mr. Wood has low intellectual ability. He also has some mental health issues. Those issues compromise the ability of the defense to present mitigating evidence at his trial. It also caused the execution to be delayed when it was first scheduled almost 10 years ago. So those issues might well interfere with the state's being able to carry out the execution. Those issues also make the underlying conviction problematic, because if his mental health or lack of intellectual ability contributed to his being an accomplice, it's that much worse that he's convicted not for his own acts, but for the acts of another.
Although I gather from the tone in your voice, Professor Steiker, you believe this is just going to happen and that there's not much standing in its way.
Well, unfortunately, my years in Texas have shown me that Texas rarely misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity for justice in these cases.
Where do we go from here? I mean, the execution is a few weeks away. It would really take a governor's clemency decision to stop anything at this point?
Well, the state courts are in a position to prevent the execution from going forward. There may be a subsequent petition in federal court. The most appropriate place for this case to be resolved would be in the Board of Pardons and Paroles and the governor's office, because they have the power to make a judgment that death is not the appropriate punishment. And I think any fair reading of these facts suggests that Wood is just not among the worst of the worst offenders. And if you have a death penalty that is designed to address the worst of the worst, it seems crazy to apply it to someone who didn't have a weapon, who wasn't present when the murder was carried out, and who didn't intend for the murder to occur.
Jordan Steiker is professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law and the director of the Capital Punishment Center there. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
more and more people are using more and more of the ocean, so the pressures have ramped up.
My favorite thing about the ocean is the sound of the waves.
I realized I came across more plastic bags than fish.
Go to the beach and fly my kite and go on the boardwalk.
The more science we do, the bigger this problem appears.
If we don't conserve the oceans, it would be really terrible.
It'd be super heartbreaking.
Unfathomable to me.
It keeps us alive. Protecting nature is the best investment we can make.
All this week, our series Trashing the High Seas is exploring the interconnection between humans and our oceans. We dispelled some mythology about Milwaukee earlier this hour. Well, there's plenty of mythology about life under the ocean surface. Monsters and utopias, Jules Verne's Captain Nemo dreamt of an undersea paradise in his 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
See how peaceful it is here. The sea is everything. An immense reservoir of nature where I roam at will.
Today we know it's no paradise under the seas, but how to quantify what remains there in resources and habitats? The Nature Conservancy, an organization devoted to protecting ecologically important lands and waters, has been creating an atlas of ocean wealth. Mark Spalding, senior marine scientist at the Nature Conservancy, is the lead author of this atlas. He says the project started at least 10 years ago. The work began with trying to determine the value of oysters to ecosystems.
Oysters, as you may know, are fairly diminutive little creatures, but they can grow into huge banks or reefs. Those banks, in fact, when the first European settlers came to the US, were so huge that they were a navigational hazard. But those banks weren't just a navigational hazard or a food supply. They were also tremendous resources. Those oysters filtered the water. They acted as a habitat for young fish, so they added fish to the estuaries around the US. And we realized that, and we started to look into it. We also started to restore oyster reefs. But what we've done a little bit more recently is start to say, well, exactly how much water does an oyster filter? And that number's a pretty surprising number. It's one oyster is going to filter 180 liters of water a day. And there are obviously millions of oysters in some of these reefs. With that comes improvements in water quality, improvements in clarity. The sunlight can filter through the water and get to the seabed. Then seagrasses start to grow. Suddenly, you've got a complex of ecosystems and an abundance of fish that we've largely lost. But we realized that we could model this and start to build it up. And with those models, we can say exactly how much an additional acre of oysters or an additional mile of coral reefs or whatever will give you in terms of benefits to people. You can translate that into dollars or jobs or whatever it might be.
And if I was holding the atlas or if I was encountering the atlas directly, what kinds of explorations could I go on? What could I see? What kinds of comparisons could I make?
We focused on five major sets of benefits that nature gives to people. So the first part of the atlas focuses on fish production. We think about habitats as fish factories, and certain parts of the ocean generate lots of fish. And we work at multiple scales. So there are global maps in the atlas where you can just see how much fish are being produced by coral reefs, by mangrove forests, and so on. And at times we zoom right in. So we tell the story about the seagrass beds of Australia, for example, where one additional hectare of seagrass is going to generate an additional 30,000 fish into an estuary worth $24,000. That's every year. So that's a huge amount from an area that's pretty much 100 yards by 100 yards. It's a pretty small area.
Well, it's all very compelling. And I guess what kind of circulation do you envision for this atlas? And how much of a reference would it become in the sense that people in schools would refer to it as frequently as they refer to other more traditional reference books?
I think the atlas is part of a movement. I don't know that our atlas will be the definitive turning point. I hope it'll get out to many thousands of people. So it's not just the conservationists sort of clamoring for more protected areas, but it's actually, there's a whole audience. In fact, it's everyone who benefits from a healthy ocean. So that we can have other people also calling for the sustainable use or the restoration of the ocean.
When you are trying to conflate a number of maps about a particular place, what do you have to be concerned about? I mean, I suppose the first thing is to make sure that all of the maps of the same place represent the same point in time, right?
Yeah. The other issue that comes up a lot is that, you know, we've told this story from one perspective only. We've said, okay, so coral reefs generate fish. But actually, they also generate dollars. Reefs are coastal defenses, they're fish factories, they are tourist destinations, and on all of those fronts, they add value. And that's also quite often when nature services stand out from the replacement that we give them. So we talk, for example, of the value of seawalls or sea defenses to try and stop erosion on coasts. But the concrete seawalls that we tend to build will only do that. Now, if we've got the space, and it won't work everywhere, but if we've got the space and the models show us it'll work, we can put a mangrove forest instead of a seawall. We won't only get the protection from wave erosion, but we'll also get tons, literally tons of extra fish per kilometer of coast. And we will also get storage of carbon, because mangroves are the most efficient forests in the world for taking carbon dioxide out of the air and packing it into the soil. So we'll get a host of other benefits, which you'd never get from a seawall.
How much of this atlas is a charge for explorers and scientists to finish the project of documenting the ocean, both in terms of its surface, its mid-level zones, and of course the bottom of the ocean, which has not been fully mapped?
I think our premise was actually we know enough to make a start. And so our mantra in this was review what's out there, model it, and map it. There are gaps in the knowledge, and we must push towards filling those gaps.
What's your favorite place in the ocean?
I'm really lucky. I have a parallel job which gets me out to a very remote corner of the Indian Ocean once a year. It's called the British Indian Ocean Territory. And it's one of the few pristine places left on the planet, or near pristine. I just have to say that it's remarkable to go out to a place like that and see just how productive a coral reef can be. And these reefs are heaving with fish. But I think seeing a place like that is, yeah, of course, it's kind of inspirational and wonderful and beautiful, but it also, you know, increases my conviction of just how incredibly productive and powerful the oceans are, and how we really just can't afford to mess this up.
Mark Spaulding is senior marine scientist at the Nature Conservancy and lead author of the Atlas of Ocean Wealth. Thank you so much, Mark.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Policing the people, Babylon. Policing the people, policing the people.
People Get Ready, the summer of 2016's Protest Sounds, introduces us to Himanshu Suri, otherwise known by his stage name Heems, a 31-year-old rapper born in Queens to Indian Hindu parents. Heems started the group Das Racist with a college friend. Its viral first hit, combination Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, featured humor, capitalist critique, and blunt talk about race. Since Das Racist's breakup, Heems has continued to explore Indian American culture in 2016. His last album, Eat, Pray, Thug, was influenced by his experience as a high school student witnessing 9/11 and the changes it brought to himself and his community. His latest endeavor, a collaboration with actor Riz Ahmed, is called Sweatshop Boys.
Beyond my music, even if my activism, a lot of it has to do with not wanting to engage the institutions around us, having a fear of them, not reaching out to have the resources, not feeling like we'll be granted those resources. And a lot of it from that becomes a lack of not just visibility, but empathy, a lack of humanizing our community. And so Khizr Khan, Captain Khan's father, that was such a moment, moving towards humanization, moving towards being seen as actual people and not this other. And I am human. And beyond that, I'm a human who contributed to our American side of this narrative.
Why would it be the case to say, I am here, is a revolutionary protest message in the United States?
I don't know. I wonder that every day. But it seems, I mean, it's necessary. And just yesterday, somebody online said that they had been searched at the airport for explosives in front of their family. And so my record took on a different meaning for them after that. To me, it's clear that we're here. But it's this constant otherization that really makes it important to actually show that we're here, to reach people on a human level, and not just, you know, for Khizr Khan to talk about Captain Khan being a part of that institution, of this institution, of our narrative.
And our parents began to fear for our lives whenever we walked out the door, because they read the news and another cab driver was beaten to death. And yesterday, more than 10 years later, another man from the neighborhood was deported. I went to expensive white people's school with his daughter. For 4 years, we read books, and together we yelled, I'm just like you.
On my song Flag Shopping, I talked about the experience of forced patriotism, having to buy flags to put on your windows, on your car, as a bumper sticker, just so your neighbors who have known you for years understand that you're just like them.
We're going flag shopping for American flags. They're staring at our turbans, they're calling them rags. They're calling them towels, they're calling them diapers. They're more like crowns, let's strike them like vipers. I know why they mad, but why call us Arabs? We sad like they sad, but now we buy they flags. Spying on our
Muslim. Do you, as an artist, get the most pleasure out of making people feel uncomfortable if they hear your songs?
I think initially when I was younger, a lot of my approach did involve in kind of making the audience feel as uncomfortable as I've been made to feel throughout time. But now it becomes more from a place of just trying to make them empathize without the uncomfortableness. If people say that art is meant to evoke a feeling in someone, well, then uncomfortableness is a feeling as well.
You know, there is a certain amount of South Asian art, and your collaborator, Riz Ahmed, does some of the parodying of characters in the South Asian community in the United States trying to get over uncomfortableness, deal with the white majority and that sort of thing. Do you shy away from that?
No, I've moved closer and closer to that. I wouldn't say necessarily parodying is the right word, but Riz is talented in so many ways. I mean, acting is one way, and up until now his acting career, you know, he's taken on these roles that do subvert the idea of, you know, the terrorist South Asian role, the cab driver South Asian role, the bodega man South Asian role. Now his career with, he has The Night Of, but also his Star Wars Rogue One coming up. And so he definitely hasn't shied away from that. In his music, he certainly hasn't as well with his recent mixtape, Inglistan.
God save the queen. Now she ain't made for me, but she keeps my paper green. Plus we made the sea on this little island where we all surviving. Politeness mixed with violence.
I think after my first band, That's Racist, broke up, I felt a certain freedom to not just talk about race in larger terms in America, but have talk about it more in personal terms of what I've experienced. And that's something I feel really glad that I've been able to do. And I think this next album with Riz just kind of pushes that further.
Inshallah, mashallah, hopefully no martial law. Hell yalla, yo yalla, let's rock a show in Ramallah. Kick it with Muhammad when I'm out in Haifa. Kick it with Muhammad when I'm out in Jaffa. I be on the road like every single year, and I ain't seen nowhere just like Hoffa. Do it so proper, looking like a doctor. At the checkpoint, say my visa's doctored. IDF all around running with them choppers. Wanna shoot my papa, got me drinking vodka. Got me feeling paranoid, got me drinking wine. Bad, bad ting, and I love how she whines. She don't eat swine, and she looks so divine. I was looking for love in Palestine. Oh no.
I guess for me, it's really how many different mediums can I use to tell this story, and I feel like a rap, I've definitely done it a lot. I would love to be in a world where I wouldn't have to tell this story over and over again.
I think a lot of people in the United States buy into this narrative that, like, okay, things are bad, but it's getting better. It used to be slavery, then it was Jim Crow, now it's sort of hidden racism that turns into police shootings, you know, whatever.
Prison-industrial complex.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, okay, these are the stages until we get to some sort of summit of racial justice. There's quite another narrative, which is just actually we're just making the same mistake over and over again.
Well, I feel like
there's no progress.
Different loopholes being worked into the same system that's using loopholes for the same goals, which is to keep the status quo of class and race in the structure that it's been.
What's the Heems version of We Shall Overcome?
Black Lives Matter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You sound like sometimes in your writing that you're concerned about adopting this African-American narrative within a...
I feel like it's a community where so much of their culture has been taken. I think with the South Asian community and our history of immigration, it's been we want your labor, not your lives. With the African-American community, it certainly started with slavery, with we want your labor, not your lives. And I think that still goes on, but there's a lot more of we want your culture as well, but not your lives. And I think, you know, as Indian, as South Asians become more visible in America, there is a certain amount of, okay, now we want your culture too, but not to the same extent that African-Americans have been through it. We have South Asians on TV and films. We have musicians like myself. And I think from that increased visibility comes a better understanding. But I said in a song recently, it was like a... something to the effect of, like, when I was younger, it was like, yeah, you smell like curry. And now it's kind of like, hey, what's that recipe? How do I get that? And I won't speak on behalf of other South Asians. I think perhaps that assimilation is a great thing. But then you do get protective of your culture to a certain extent. And so it becomes, which one was better? Was it better when people would just outright be racist, or this new, you know, appropriative quality of still not really understanding where people come from? But I think the difference is, you know, are you just taking the food, the music, and, you know, making it your own? Or does it come from a place of understanding? Does it come from a similar experience? Does it come from, like, do you give something back, mm-hmm. or do you just take? And I think the narrative in America has been, we'll just take and we won't give back.
That's Himanshu Suri, better known as Heems. He and Riz Ahmed make up the rap duo Sweatshop Boys. Their album Kashmir is out October 14th.
Heemy, 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 heemy. Sweatshop Boys.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.